Jed. Are you
Death has come to your little town. You know what Haddonfield is? Families, children, all lined up in rows up and down these streets. You're telling me they're lined up for a slaughterhouse? They could be.
For over 40 years, the Halloween series has thrilled and terrified audiences. From its low-budget origins to spawning a new era of slashers, the franchise remains a cultural touchstone around the world, often referred to as the Gone with the Wind of horror. From the first chilling notes of the iconic score to the final frame, join Joel Brown as we explore the iconic horror series, digging deep into the characters, the storylines, and the spine-chilling scares. Welcome to Talking Shape with Joel Brown, the ultimate podcast for Halloween franchise enthusiasts.
Welcome to part two of our interview with the director of Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, the Swiss-French director, Dominique Othenin-Girard. And we mentioned him a little bit earlier, Donald Pleasance, in that classic line that was written for him. Someone mentioned that he kind of saw the role of Dr. Sam Loomis as like a role, like a Shakespeare character.
I love the actors. I love actors. I love working with actors, really. It's fantastic. And Donald wanted to be out of Halloween movies. Mustafa pressured him contractually to do 5. And Donald said, okay, it's my last one. That was in the background before he came to the set. And then on the set, he wanted to be the good guy. But he felt that he played the good guy. And I said, no, you're going to be tough with it, Jamie. You are out of your wits. You are so pissed off of not having found that Michael Myers is still out, and you're a psychiatrist. You haven't found a reason for him and how to get to him. You are going to be really tough with this little girl. And he's tough in the hospital ward with her. He yells at her. He tells her. He wanted to be the good figure for his last movie. He didn't want to be the bad figure for his last movie. But with Mustafa's agreement and Donald, we had the right to kill him at the end. And we're supposing that he slamming with this 2x4 Michael Myers under this net of metal and so on, he has a heart attack and dies. I wanted to leave it open. Did he really die, or is he going to be saved by the police? But anyways, it's there. And a factor that we, again, K&B, genius of the makeup special effects, did his burnt marks so strong, and that Donald had to be 2.5 hours under the makeup every day before his shoot, made him be in a bad mood, basically. I didn't feel he liked to be there. It was not so easy to have an actor who wants to be off from the set, who has suffered 2 hours in makeup and who sort of martyrized a little girl, and liked it very much when he's calling to the wood to say, Michael, she's going to be home. You've got to come home. Not knowing if Michael holds. And this is the Shakespearean speech performance, because he gave it, and I said, no. You've got to give it with your heart. This is the end. This is your last moment, you know, with Michael and so on. And he understood, and there he was like an amazing actor, coming out and being able to express himself instead of just being the actor inside a little rooms and so it was great to work. We really clicked there. He understood I was a director, knowing what it is to have a piece of a moment in film, and I was seeing him as a great actor at that moment.
It will destroy you too. One day, Michael, this rage which drives you think if you kill them all, it will go away. It won't. You have to fight it in the place where it's strongest. Where it all began. If you want to get rid of this rage, Michael, go home. Go home!
And we go from, I guess, someone whose career was wrapping up, so to speak, or he's towards the end of his career, to someone whose career was very much beginning, being Danielle Harris as Jamie Lloyd. I think she's about 10 or 11 here. A lot of people say, for a young girl, she holds the film, and the first half of the movie, she's not talking, and all the stunt work you said about the laundry chute scene. What was it like working with a young Danielle Harris? Because I believe the saying is don't work with animals and don't work with children or with young kids. And I think she by all accounts did a great job.
I inherited Danielle. I didn't do casting. I did casting with Billy. What's the actor's name of Billy, the young boy?
Jeffrey Landman.
Exactly. Fantastic, too. I felt her performance was just okay in Halloween 4. Barely okay, basically. That she was walking through the picture, but didn't give it. And I was afraid. Because I wouldn't forgive myself to get a performance like that. And he was real. He was having fun. I made sure that she was never in a situation of being scared. When you'd make a horror movie, you go through a journey where, as a spectator, when let me take it the other way around. We had a screening in Los Angeles at the a very special screening of the film. We invited her and so on, and she was there, and we sat both of us quite in front of the theater, and she looked at the first few minutes of the film with me, and she got scared. I saw this little girl who shot the movie, who looks at herself, and who looks at the situation where that little girl is put, the hospital where she goes down in the gurney, and then, the scalpel comes close to her. And she goes, "Come." I said, "Come, let's go and eat ice creams." And we went out of the theater after 5 minutes and we ate ice creams. And I was very happy to see that during the movie, she didn't realize what was happening. Every shot was a game. But I needed to set her emotionally correctly for that shot. So when she's inside the house, for example, in the corridors, and Michael Myers is walking towards her, and she looks at him, and she's afraid, and she has to run down the corridor. What do I do? I don't show Michael Myers, because to look at him doesn't mean much. I shoot on her shot. But what do? I run around this house with her, holding her hand, and I do 10 times the corridors, running, running, running. The camera is ready, everything else. And then I put her in front of the camera. I go behind the camera. I say, "Go, shoot, roll." And she's there out of breath because she just ran with me like crazy. And she emotionally, she's already in the state of the scene. And I am there behind the camera and I'm talking to her. I say, "Ah, go, And I go with my voice, and she knows it's a game. She knows I'm a clown. She knows Dominic, you know, because we laugh off the set together and so on. I don't show her the knife with Michael or so, you know, or in the forest when she has to roll, she's on the floor. She sees before the car crashes against the tree. This is a very emotional scene for her. She's tramping on the floor with her legs and foot. She has no more strength and she's afraid, and he's getting out of the car after the car. She has a relief. The car crash is a relief. What? And she hears Billy far away. There's hope. So from fear to hope to now even more fear, because he gets out of the car and he almost kills her and she has to be terrified. And Tina comes in to stop him, and she witnesses Tina being killed. I mean, for a character to pass from these different emotions, you've got... So I was the one who was talking to her during the shots. The editor was saying, Dominique, cut your voice. Can't you stop talking? No, I had to talk for her shots. I was telling her, you know, I was... And she worked well. We had this communication, and she was really fantastic. And when I was shooting the reverse shots on Michael or on Tina or and so on, she would become, I was looking at my small little screen, and suddenly my hand would have bites. She would put my little pinky into her mouth and she would bite it, saying, "And me, you don't want to shoot with me?" She was like wanting to be part of the shot. She liked it so much, you know? It was so great. And the laundry shoot. You know, we had 20 pieces of tubes of the laundry chute in a warehouse put on tables to shoot this laundry chute. It was not at all into a vertical real laundry chute. We had the laundry chute both ending inside the house on the exterior, but all of what's happening in the interior of the laundry chute was done as a game. And we had a day to shoot that. And because we needed to set the lights inside this tube, because, you know, without lights, you only have black on the film. So she was for the famous fall away from the camera, and we believe it is vertically the fall, you know, it was horizontal, and she was on the roller skate. Her stomach and so on was on the roller skate, and her hands were pulled forward, like if she held something, and we were with a rope behind her, pulling the roller skate away from the camera. That was a game. So it was always very... enjoyable experiences of fear and so on. It was never a real dangerous or hurting Danielle. So it was, everything was planned in a way so that she could perform and we could film it well, have the material well, good in the camera.
You said earlier that you're going in there to make certain changes or to, you know, to change certain things. And fans were very upset when Halloween 4 Final Girl Rachel, Ellie Cornell, when she was killed off so early in Halloween 5. But I kind of got the Alfred Hitchcock-esque of that, and the raising the stakes of the film, like someone who was loved in the previous film being killed off early. I imagine that was the reason, right?
Talked about with Mustafa, and I said, this is the kind of expectation for the audience. You don't want to have the same character going through your movie, the second movie. You want to discover new characters. And we had Tina and the other girl that were such a great pair. So they were very different one from another, the cast. And She's such a good girl, Rachel. She was such the emblematic, perfect Americana, Midwestern Americana, good girl, that her innocence had to be punished. We had to be angry at the fact that she leaves so soon the screen because she's killed so fast. I thought that would provoke to the audience some kind of interest for the rest of the movie, even if it is by anger.
You mentioned there with Rachel's character sort of angering the audience or the fans. And do you think inadvertently that anger went towards the Tina character, Wendy Kaplan? I mean, I'd have to say that she would have to be one of the most hated characters in the Halloween franchise if you talk to a lot of people. As a kid, when I watched the film, I really loved Tina, but I think a lot of people didn't like Tina. In your opinion, why do you think that's the case?
Yes, I believe that some of the anger is geared due to the fact that I killed Rachel early. Definitely. That's part of it. The other part was possibly the freedom of Tina. She's so free in her expression, so generous, so strong. Probably the audience would prefer someone a little more reserved, held back. And I love that, the fact that she was so open-minded. Also in she's encouraging her girlfriend to have sex for the first time. You know, it's also that possibly is something that is not appreciated or so, because she's speaking about it freely, and she has a boyfriend that is really sort of a little sleaze, a guy who loves car, a guy who sort of is a bad boy, you know, the boyfriend of Tina. And I guess all of these ingredients made that happen. I'm sorry, because I loved her and I loved the actress. She was fantastic.
Oh, like I said, as a kid, I really loved Tina, and I felt for when Tina when she was killed off in Halloween 5. But it was only sort of revisiting the series as an adult that a lot of people were like, oh, I don't like Tina, she's annoying or whatever. But you bring up some interesting points that, yeah, you know, like she lives with a freedom that maybe that us in the real world, we are a little bit kind of held back, or we don't express ourselves as much as we can, and people have trouble seeing that.
Someone who's too frank and too out there speaking openly is threatening and is not necessarily appreciated.
What about the bumbling cops and the clown sound effects when they would walk out of the house, or they would nod at each other and look at each other?
All clear.
Nothing above, nothing below.
I don't know what you're talking about. You know, yes, a little bit of a sort of a outrageous Laurel and Hardy comedy part. I don't know. It was in order to be a little bit, it's an over-the-top distraction to the building of the tension. It was still the beginning of the film. I wanted to have a little bit of goofball things. These two guys were cast really because of their difference, you know, one short, one tall, one, you know, and I exaggerated that in order to surprise, to say, what the fuck, where are we? What's happening? And I may have done it too much, but you know, Alan Howard with the music went for it. I said, are you crazy? And I said, well, okay, let's keep it, you know, let's try it, and so on. Mustafa kept it, and, you know, sort of we went with it. But I'm not so sure today I would go again with such choices.
And you mentioned Alan there, who, you know, a lot of people know through the Halloween franchise and collaborating with the likes of John Carpenter. He said that you were really, like, I think that the previous director for Halloween 4 maybe visited once a month or however long the period was, but you were in there twice a week and were really interested in the music side and getting back to our basics with the piano.
Yeah. You know, one forgets easily that audio is huge part of making a horror film succeed. And Alan, in our first meeting, says, you know, I'm not a composer, Dominique. I'm a sound special effects creator. I said, interesting, good. But I've got the rights of John Carpenter's music theme and so on, and he trusts me to work with that and to adapt it and so on. So here you go. You got me. I said, fantastic. Let's work together. And, you know, to build attention in a movie, it's more by sound and music than by image, necessarily. The image can be good and destabilizing, but the audio makes all the effect. And that's why I thought I loved working with Howard, because he was very open-minded. And I wanted to go back to the bare basic, because that little music is ominous. The theme is ominous and played not symphonically, but simply is even more creepy. It makes me think of children's night music, those little sort of instrument that you play for babies to go fall asleep. And I wanted a bit of that. And that's, I thought that's even more horrible, because we all heard this kind of little sounds when we were kids. And if it is played to bring up evil, it sort of jolts something in through the audience, recollection or emotions. It's not right. And you know, storytelling is about sowing contrasts, sowing conflicts. A character wants something, we're interested into the obstacles that he has to surmount in order to get that thing. That's what it is about, storytelling. And music is part of it. It's also, for me, viewed this way. We accompany the character somewhere, and the music needs to be either the obstacle or coloring the big goal of the character.
Make sure to check out season 1 of Talking Shape. Interviews and insights into the Halloween franchise, including former HalloweenMovies.com webmaster Anthony Massey.
When Freddy vs. Jason came out, Mustafa called me on my phone, and I was like, holy, the man never called me. And I'm like, what's wrong? And he said, I was just on the phone with Dimension, and he said, they want to pit Michael against Pinhead. And I feel like that's the worst thing to do, and I want to prove them wrong. Can you put a poll up on the website and ask the fans?
Sandy Johnson, who played Judith Myers in the original Halloween 1978.
Blumhouse. They were looking for me because they wanted to use that footage in the cemetery. But in order to do that, they had to have me sign off on it. Well, of course, I'd been missing for 40 years. Nobody knew where I was, and I didn't know anybody cared. And so they were able to get my signature so that I could be in it again.
And Daniel Farrens, the writer of Halloween 6.
And the one thing I remember saying to him in that meeting was, it's Rosemary's Baby meets Halloween. That was like the kind of elevator pitch tagline that I said out loud. And his eyes just kind of grew wide. It was almost like, you know, in interviews, and this all happened later, all these interviews that I saw, you know, different documentaries on Halloween. But I remember Mustafa saying then, like, oh, the reason I greenlit Halloween, the original in 78, was that John Carpenter came in to me with a very simple pitch. The boogeyman murders babysitters on Halloween. And he understood that. So when I said Rosemary's Baby meets Halloween, he understood that. It was a simple concept that grasped it right away. Go and write a treatment, come back to us in a week. If we like it, we'll go to the next step.
Talking Shape Season 1, now available wherever you stream your podcasts.
With the benefit of hindsight, what would an older Dominique say to a younger Dominique now? Like, say, would you have done anything particularly different? I know you mentioned the sound effect with the bumbling cops, but what if you were on set, your older self, and you saw your younger self, would there be anything that you would pass on in regards to the production, or perhaps maybe just in the industry or a life thing?
You're good, Joel. You got an interesting question, Joel.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Interesting question. I would look at the script. I would focus further onto the structure of how the story unrolls. And I would say to the young Dominique, check out your script first, even further. I think we could have gone further with the script in the screenplay. In general, I don't have such viewpoint. You know, there's maybe 20 years I haven't seen Halloween 5. I don't recollect all the moments. I know the choices I made at the time, I would make them again. Very often, structure of the story.
Yeah. And how did the experience of directing Halloween 5, how did that influence your, subsequent projects and collaborations and just being attached to that film and this franchise? How did that affect you?
It was an immense learning experience to do Halloween 5. The freedom Mustafa Akkad gave me was very precious. He liked me and we worked well together. And we had our differences here and there, right and left. But he accompanied me. When I said I can't work with Rob Draper anymore, Mustafa said immediately, change him. Let's fire him, Dominique. And I said, what? Really? Yeah. You need to be comfortable with your DP. And okay. And Rob was fired. And I hired him the same night again. Then my growth. Yeah, I did a family film with a Down syndrome character being the central character of the film. And she's my sister-in-law, the sister of my wife. We adopted her and so on. And she played the main character. And it was not a biographical story, but it was a story inspired by her. And for this little family movie, which is not a horror genre, I used a Steadicam the whole movie, for example, because I learned a tool of how to tell a story. I didn't want to give her very specific marks, you know, stop there so that the camera is in focus when the actor falls in front of the camera or so. You know, I just wanted to be a little loose. To live with her, to breathe with her, to dance with the character, around the character. And that I've learned from Halloween 5. Having done Halloween 5, I've learned tricks on how to make choices with telling the story visually and how, the importance of visual storytelling. With Rob Draper, he made his friend, I forget the name now, the Steadicam operator, great artist, come to the set and do the Steadicam for us. And, at that time, we were shooting 35 millimeter. It was not digital. And the camera was blimped, meaning it had a case around the camera. It was very heavy. And to hold the Steadicam and with very heavy camera and the lens and so on was immense. He would always put the camera down, obviously, because he couldn't hold it for us to see the shot and so on. And I was designing shots and they were talking about, he designed this shot this way. For me, it was more instinctive and following Michael from the back and seeing the point of view of Michael onto his target, his victim, and so on. I use it with this kind of language. And Rob Draper and Ted Churchill, who was a Steadicam operator, were really making me realize that Steadicam was a language. Without them too, without me doing this experience of Halloween 5, I would not have learned this tool further in my career. That's one example. Light concept that I dared try to use and to stay rigorous when I first talked to Rob and said, look, I want a jolly, very fun movie, light colors, pastel at the beginning and really hard contrast, black and white at the end, you know, clair obscur, you know, for the end. This is, and Rob said, ah, yes, that's like Vilos Sigmund, you know, other great DPs who worked this way. The fact that it worked so well on Halloween 5 was giving me some kind of confidence in choices, in limitations that I give myself as a director for the rest of my film career.
Rob Draper, fellow Australian as well.
Yeah.
We've been told that we talk really fast because we sort of cut our words and things like that. But I think Rob's, you know, been in America for quite some time. But was there any sort of cultural things that you noticed with Rob or anything funny Australian-wise that you picked up on?
Yeah, actually, you're right. Our clash came from cultural differences. Not from anything else. We didn't understand each other. We were starting to shoot and so on, and he was always making comments in the back that I didn't know what it was about after I've set the shot. I'm very precise. You know, for example, the Jamie being in hospital, being woken up when Michael Myers is waking up at the Hermit at the very beginning of the film. And she's writing without seeing on the board. And I said, you know, this is lightning. It has to be really terrifying, the outside. And I want the crash of the lightning, really strong and so on. I want her to be out of breath in her bed. It's scary. And then they come in the room. They put her onto the gurney. The gurney goes through the corridors, goes through the staircase, goes through the door of the operating theater. And there I want the shot to be upside down. And let's set the camera on top of the doorway so that we have a normal horizontal shot. And then as the gurney goes down under the doorway, we are punching onto her face. And then when the gurney goes into the operating room, the camera continues and we see her upside down. I said, oh, again, a student film shot. I said, what? And this is cultural. He meant when he said that again, because it's very difficult to set a camera that does a 180 degrees shot manipulated from the top of a doorway that looks on one side of the corridor into the room. It's very difficult to place the camera, these big body things and so on to do. It is not at all simple. And I'm demanding this, and we don't have time because we're shooting in real night and he has the lighting from outside and so on. And, you know, I'm asking him for very difficult things. I'm asking him to see the room with wide angle. I want to be right in the face of Jamie, and I want the face to be huge in the camera and then very small, you know, like a breathing thing. And instead of having the camera a little bit further with a longer lens where the character can be moving, but it doesn't have such effect onto the audience. And requesting these wide angles means that he cannot put a light in the room. It's terrible. For the DP, you know, you see the ceiling, you see the floor, you see the wall on the left, the one on the right, and I want the character to go around the room. So he's fucked. It's very tough. And I know that. And we clashed because of his probably, yeah, him, when he says it's another student film shot, he says it's another invention. For him, it was pretty, it was not pejorative. I thought he was making fun of me to his crew. And then the crew was like not motivated to make the gear to hold the camera there and to have the light to be outside the hospital on the third floor, and they have to rig these lights so high so that they could light the scene from the windows. This is awful, you know? And his crew was not so motivated. And so I said, you know, we wanted to separate. I said, I can't work. You're not my ally. You're doing your film with your crew, and I feel alone here. You're not coming with me. And we had a talk. At 10 o'clock at night, he had his suitcase all packed with his two kids and his wife. He was ready to take the plane the next morning and so on. And we had a good two-hour talk that night. I said, come on, stay. And they stayed. And we then, from that moment on, finished the movie in a great way. He was my partner. We were just like really close, and he was agreeing to go into a direction that was unusual, maybe very personal, very Frenchy, maybe. That's what Danielle would say, you know. I'm not an ordinary sort of by the book kind of a guy. That's, you know, I do things a little bit differently, even if the results are similar to the by the book kind of a guy. But you know, in this case, he had to give in, and had to give in to understand him, and understood afterwards the Australian type of cultural accent and making fun and fast way of talking. English is not my first language, obviously. You know, it's tough for me, and for him, he had to pay attention on how I say things. And sometimes when you are in front of a scene, before shooting the scene, you don't know exactly what the components of the scene are going to be. You have a vision. How to explain a vision to someone, a DP, an actor, and so on. You know, you have to lead them, and the director's job is to talk to everyone so that they complement this vision. They go in the direction of the vision of the scene. The scene with Jamie being into the laundry in the psychiatric hospital, she runs away from this shadow of the gardener who looks like Michael Myers, and she goes down into the basement, and she goes through the sheets that are hanging, drying, and then she goes into this room where there's the heater, the heating devices, and so on. Is a scene that I improvised. I said, I want the sheets to be drying there. And I would like to see Chinese shadows of Michael Myers behind the sheets and her, and they get entangled in the sheets. And maybe the light goes off and on. And Rob built that scene with me in the sense of wide angle handheld, because I wanted to have fast movements. It was not anymore the time for Steadicam, and to have flash of neon tubes flashing, not being totally regular, and we built the scene, and Mustafa Akkad said, it's never going to make the film, this scene, it's too horrible, it's too scary. And once he saw it editing, he said it was shit, you know, when he knew I was making the scenes. He said, what is Dominic doing in the basement? Why doesn't he confront the girl with Michael? He's using two more hours of shooting day. I said, yeah, but it's suspenseful. This is what, you know, your film is about. It's suspense. Is she going to survive or not this laundry scene? And once he saw it, he said, ah, great, and so on. But, you know, sometimes people don't have the possibility to see what's going to happen when you enter into a poor set with just hanging sheets, you know, and we created a moment.
And I think we've robbed potentially, and this is an Australian, we talk about cultural and Australian thing. I think I'm trying to think of a way how to explain it. Like, Australians have dry humor, and I think sarcasm is part of that. And it can be interpreted as insults, but it's not meant that way, if that makes sense.
That's what he explained to me. That's why we got along. I thought it was insulting.
Yeah.
You know, consciously, this kind of sarcasm comments and so on. But he thought, no, it is because I liked it. And I made these comments.
Yeah.
And we sorted that out. Thank you for explaining it.
Looking forward this year, being the 35th anniversary of Halloween 5, do you have any plans or any chance that you'll put Halloween 5 on this year and revisit it and view it again?
Why not? I mean, you know, time for me means nothing. I mean, 35 years or yesterday, I mean, when I talk to you, I see the scenes as if I'm in the scenes. For example, the laundry chutes or so, I have this recollection. For me, it hasn't got dust on it, you know, it hasn't accumulated time. It's not old memories or so. I remember, you know, Don Shanks vividly, as I saw him and looked up. You know, he's so tall, I need to look up at him, and I like that. You know, his hand is so big and valuable and frank and honest, and you know, for me it's real today. So nostalgia, why not watching the movie? Sure. You know, maybe in the theater that would be nice, with an audience or so, with my friends of today, I guess. We almost redid several times a movie with Malek, son of Mustafa. Malek, who was a kid on the set of Halloween 5, he was 9 years old or 8 or 9 years old. And I was telling him, come and have a look. And he was a little kid, you know, next to Jamie and so on. And Malek asked me several times if it was possible to redo an installment or so. And it didn't work out for scheduling purposes or other things. Or so I wouldn't have been against it at all. I thought it was a fun experience. And today, I would do one, taking similar freedoms as I took in Halloween 5 compared to the legacy that I received, because I do believe that each film needs to hold on their own, even if they are part of a whole series, you know, and some decisions directors or writers need to take is to make that piece work. And that's my focus, and Mustafa understood this. I want to clear one thing out. My contract with Mustafa, being paid poorly for the job, my agent created a clause on the contract saying, all right, residuals. And Mustafa says, you're not coming into it. You're not coming into my accounting. This is out of question. And so my agent found a way of saying, if the Variety publishes the figures, upon the figures published in the Variety, once the film hits $12 million, from there on, each $500,000, Dominique gets $20,000 or $30,000. Mustafa said, okay. And that was in my contract. And what we did not expect is that the producer has the right to say, don't publish my figures anymore. And as soon as the film hit the $12 million bar, Mustafa asked the Variety not to publish anymore. And so I was screwed. I was screwed from my residuals. A year, 2 years later, the Hollywood Reporter was publishing the figures of the film, who did $56 million worldwide or in the States or so. And we went back with my agent, and Mustafa said, well, it's Hollywood Reporter, it's not Variety.
Right, because
so
the
film got a bad rep, saying it only did $12 million, but that's not true at all. That's due to the fact that I had a contract as such with Trancas International.
A lot of people, they say that it's the least performing film in the franchise. But do you think that was on purpose? So then, obviously, they wouldn't have to pay you, like you said, the residuals, correct?
Yeah. That's the attitude of Mustafa, saving wherever he could, and that's part of a man, you know. It's like, also that year in '89, if you look at the figures of Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, the figures are extremely low. We were all panicked because suddenly serial films did not work anymore on the market. And so the fact that this happened, but we hit, I mean, $56 million was not poor, but it was simply not published. And I have the photocopy of the Hollywood Reporter's figures, the article and so on, that proves it. It was like unfortunate for the reputation of Halloween that Mustafa took this decision.
And I mean, that's a pretty big revelation. I mean, the reporter that reported on that, is that knowledge out there? Would you say there's other people that know of that information?
I don't know. Well, surely it was there. It was not a specific article on Halloween 5. It was within the serial and these movies did and so on. It was an article that was speaking, and that it was 2 years later. It was not close to the date of the release of Halloween 5. It was not in 89. It was either 90 or 91 or so, you know, that it came out. I fell upon it totally by random. I don't know. And it must have been out there. But, you know, it's not known, linked to Halloween. When you look at Halloween, probably if you look at the fact that in '90s, in those years, you don't have digital. It's all paper. And once you, the paper, who goes into the archives looking at every Hollywood Reporter to see where Halloween 5 may have been published in numbers? It's today, it would have been widely known. At the time, you know, who cares? It was already set in the mind of the people that Halloween 5 did not do well in the box office. And in fact, I feel terrible about it because it's not true. It did very well.
When you look back at it, do you look back and see that you were having fun? Because there's footage out there where I think it was when you're set up in Utah or in a hotel motel, and there's lots of footage of parties. Do you have any recollection of any of the parties that were happening on set?
I was not so much part of them. I so much work. I retrieved. So I know the crew was just having a great time. They were really all together because they were outside of Los Angeles, and they mixed well with the part of the crew from Utah. It was Salt Lake City we shot at, and it was really fun. They were, but I did not party very much, I have to say. I was a bit excluded from all this by myself because we were riding at night. It was such a drooling schedule. And I was planning my shot list because I didn't have such prep time, you know, new locations and so on. And when I get on the set, I like to be really prepped with storyboards, with everything, so that the crew knew exactly how to put it through the can. You know, it was not like, what are we going to do today? How? And so on. And all the hospital scenes with Loomis and Jamie. They were set. I knew I was shooting against a window. I was shooting against that. And we were shooting in discontinuity, totally, because we were shooting for locations, obviously, to move the least possible the crew and to gain as much time as possible. And, you know, I want quality shots. So I do second takes, third takes, five takes, and so on. And Mustafa said, oh, it's okay, just do two takes and so on. I said, no, I need the performance, you know. And so I had my great fun because I love making movies, and I love going to the perfection or trying to get magic into the can and so on. And somehow, if the New York Times did this very favorable critic of the film, or on the fact that there's something really going on about fear, that we touched on to a real psychic fear of the human psyche, you know, means that we worked well. We succeeded at something that was aiming at.
The great thing about the Halloween franchise is, no matter how people view each of the films, they like this one, they don't like that one, all the films, they find their audience in the end. And I think that is very true with Halloween 5. There's an audience that absolutely loves this film. And I want to thank you, Dominic, for taking the time to speak with me and talk about the behind the scenes of Halloween 5. I absolutely appreciate it. I could probably, here's an Australian slang term for you, I could chew your ears off for a few more hours talking about movies and Halloween. I greatly appreciate you taking the time speaking with us, Dominic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joel. It was a pleasure to recollect all of this. Thank you very much for the good questions and for your attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Talking Shape, the ultimate Halloween franchise podcast created by the fans. Make sure to stay up to date with the latest episodes by following Talking Shape on Twitter @talking_shape and liking us on Facebook. Feel free to give us a review on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. We appreciate your support. Until next time.
Go home! Go home!